My name is Peter Nash. I teach Hebrew and Old Testament at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary. And this week we're going to talk about David and Goliath. What we're going to talk about during this week is in the, four of these 10:30 slots is the second half of the first book of Samuel. Last week I did the first half of the first book of Samuel, and we had fun with it during the Bible study slot. But at about 9:15 last week, I noticed that my daughter was walking past. She hadn't quite made it to Narnia. Yes. So they decided to let me take the 10:30 slot. I would know that she's in Narnia. And could concentrate more fully on what I'm doing. I picked the title Davy and Goliath. No, not the TV show today. Hoping to get some of those people who grew up with Davy and Goliath, and would come in here by mistake and maybe have some fun. I always try to give these things at least what momentarily seems clever titles. Let's start with the word of prayer. Gracious God, we give you thanks for the gift of your word and the many ways in which it comes to us and the many ways in which it can be understood. We know that this makes it possible to feed us in many situations in our lives, in the many lives of your children. Give us grace to understand your word and courage to challenge it and faith to be challenged by it so that we may grow in your will. These things we ask in your name. Amen. Let's turn, I know you came for a session, not a Bible study, but I don't know any other way to do this. So if you haven't noticed the Bibles back on the corner, please grab one.
We don't have to read in Hebrew, do we?
No, that's my job. It's my job. As a matter of fact, there's only one Hebrew Bible up here, and I gave it because I was so frustrated 2 years ago when I was here and couldn't find anything. I want to start I put on the board 1 Samuel 17 and 21 because these are the two stories in the Hebrew, there are two stories in the Hebrew Bible about the death of Goliath. An Israelite hero comes and kills Goliath. And in one case, I'll tip my hand right up front so you won't be too shocked when you get there. In one case, it's, as in chapter 17, it's David, whom we all know killed Goliath, unlike the cartoon or the claymation series where Davy and Goliath were good friends. But in chapter 21, someone else kills Goliath. And his name is Elhanan, which means God is gracious, or the grace, God of grace. And we'll look at these stories. But before we get there, I want to first look at a piece of David's life, since many of you were here last week. And that's just a half a chapter ahead in 1 Samuel 16, verse 6 and following. If someone would read 6 through 13 for me. I really don't think there are any hard names like Deanne got last night in the Old Testament lesson. Okay, I'll do it. When they came, someone ready to do it? Would you?
I'll read it.
Please.
When they came, he looked on Eliab, and thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel, and he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. Then Jesse made Shema pass by, and he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. And Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. And Samuel said to Jesse, are all your sons here? And he said, there remains yet the youngest. But behold, he is keeping the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and fetch him, for we will not sit down until he comes here. And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ready and had beautiful eyes, and he was handsome. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. And Samuel rose up and went to Ramah.
Great, thank you. This is the story of David's, the first story of David's being selected as the up-and-coming king, the heir, not heir apparent, the, I'm trying to avoid a loaded term here, the usurper, can't avoid it, to Saul's throne. And a couple of interesting things happen here. We all note usually that David is the youngest son, the one that when the man of God came by Jesse's home and said, God has told me that one of your sons will be king, have them come in before me. Jesse was so sure that it wasn't him that he left him out in the field, didn't even call him in, left him out in the field with the sheep. And in the anointing of Saul, in the first few verses of chapter 9 in 1 Samuel, the thing that we're told about him is he's tall and he's good looking. And so Samuel, in the first verse here, looked at Eliab, the eldest son. Surely the Lord's anointed is now before the Lord, because of his stature and his appearance. And we get this little piece that my mother used to always quote to me. God doesn't look at the outward appearance, but on the inward appearance, or on the heart. But the main point here is that David is being set up as the king. Saul is, we've already seen a couple pieces where Saul has been told that he's out of the picture. And he's already gone, as we're about to see, he's about to go crazy after a fashion. If someone would pick up and read 14 through the end of the chapter, what is that, 23? Please.
Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. And Saul's servant said to him, behold now, an evil spirit from God is tormenting you. Let our Lord now command your servants who are before you to seek out a man who is skillful of playing the lyre. And when the evil spirit from God is upon you, he will play it, and you will be well. So Saul said to his servants, provide for me a man who can play well, and bring him to me. One of the young men answered, behold, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing, a man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech, and a man of good presence, and the Lord is with him. Therefore Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, send me David your son, who is with the sheep. And Jesse took an ass laden with bread and a skin of wine and a kid and sent them by David his son to Saul. And David came to Saul and entered his service. And Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, let David remain in my service, for he has found favor in his sight. And whenever the evil spirit from God was upon Saul, David took the lyre and played it with his hand, so that Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him.
Thank you. So here, the joke last week, we read this part for another purpose, and the joke was that David enters the court as the world's first music therapist. And he really steps in and sues Saul, and we see here that Saul loves him and gives him a permanent appointment, sort of like Holden. He comes in as a musician, but they make him do dish team or garbology. He's also going to have to carry some armor around. He's got an official position in the king's service. Do you notice anything interesting about the description, the two different descriptions of David, or two different pictures of David from verse 6 through 13 and verse 14 through 23?
Well, suddenly he's a man of war instead of just a shepherd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In 18, I have seen the son of Jesse, a Bethlehemite who is skillful at playing, a man of valor, a warrior, prudent in speech, a man of good presence, and the Lord is with him. Whereas Jesse's not even going to bring him out. There are places like this, lots of places like this in the narrative, in Hebrew narrative, where we jump, and apparently time passes and they don't bother to tell us how much time has passed. Or they have two different stories that were existing and they just set them down side by side just to move the narrative along. And if we're going to read the Hebrew Bible comfortably, we have to be aware of that so we don't get jolted. And so we don't make assumptions about the narrative thread, so that we don't begin to think that it just zips right along in the same way a narrative novel would move along today. There's another piece of this that comes up in chapter 17 where I want to look today that contrasts with 16 that is very important.
Peter, you're saying that these two passages we read could have been written at quite different times.
Exactly.
One is almost looking back, knowing who David becomes and writing that.
That's one way to look at it. One's looking back, knowing who David becomes, or there could have been some passage of time, more passage of time between 16:13 and 16:14 than is indicated by the text. So that now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, it could be a whole new episode that was written considerably later than David's anointing, although as it's pieced together here in 13 through the end of the book, where we're about to dispose of Saul as the king, it looks like if you don't read it carefully, it can look like it's a cleared narrative almost day by day or chronicling of the events. So there are at least two possibilities. One, that it's written retrospectively. The second is that there's just more time that passes in between than we see in the text itself.
Could it also be that David had more abilities than Jesse thought he did?
That's another piece that I've thought about, and that is that often, speaking as a parent, I'm surprised at what my kids can do that I didn't teach them.
Other people know they can do.
and other people know they can do. And they know that they can do.
But it seems like in the first part, he was young. Very young, and then down here he's put one of the man.
Yeah, but again, as
so
Bob just suggested, a lot of times you can be a man and your father not know it, or your mother for that matter, because especially if you're the baby. Note how people tend, even as adults coming home to family gatherings, sit at the same places at the table they did when they were growing up, take on the same roles. So you have very competent doctors, lawyers, being sometimes infantilized, I mean, treated like infants because they're the baby of the family. People who have, gone straight from whatever their teenage problems were, continue sometimes to be talked to at the table at Thanksgiving or Christmas as if they still have a drug problem or still have a staying out late at night problem or whatever it was.
Baby blues.
Pardon?
Not finishing their play.
Yeah. Even those more mundane things like, yeah, eat up all your vegetables, honey. Yeah. Here we are.
Dr. Jones.
Yeah, 35 and chief of staff at the local hospital, and somebody is there to remind you that you once shoved your peas under the table.
I'm an only child, it's true. There's nobody to share it with, it all falls on
me. Oh, lucky you. Lucky you. So there are several possibilities. The first two textual, the second sociological, psychological ways of looking at what Jesse understood. The point I want to get at, though, is that here in at the end of verse chapter 16, what's the relationship between Saul and David?
Loyal servant, admiring, it sounds like.
Yeah, real.
The
king is pleased with him. He's doing his job. They know each other. I mean, Saul loves him and sends back to the father and says, "Let him stay here. He's doing a good job." All right. Let's see how that looks in chapter 17.
Does Saul know that the Spirit of the Lord is coming to David?
Apparently not. I mean, this is again. Not again. Sorry, I keep forgetting that the weekend has passed and we're. Have at least half a new crowd. Saul was anointed first in secret, or told of his messiahship in secret, and then later had a public ceremony. David has the same sort of situation. It happens in private, only the family seems to know about it, and then later on we'll see in the text that David is publicly proclaimed and Saul is. But Saul has been rejected twice already at this point by Samuel, and therefore by God and through Samuel.
Because when Saul's servants say that he is a man of God,
mm-hmm.
It makes me wonder if the people knew that he was anointed.
Yeah. People from Bethlehem might have, but Bethlehem, as it was in the time of Jesus as it is today, a small suburb of Jerusalem, and a man of a man of God or the Lord is with him? What does it say here? The Lord is with him. Often that phrase is specifically the Lord is with him. I think you may have heard me joke about it last week in the Joseph story. Often that's a sign of troubles coming up. And it's not that's not always apparent to everyone, but it also just means, as it does in the Joseph story, he's lucky. Everything is sort of like a Midas touch. Everything he touches goes well. One of the things that Hebrew narrative is very weak on is giving us a lot of internal motivation. You read modern novels, and you can just go overwhelmed, going for pages, finding out what someone's thinking about as they pick up their pencil to begin to write. But Hebrew narrative is pretty slim on internal motivation. And that's one of the things that makes it fun. So that's one of the things that makes it frustrating. If someone would pick up with 17:1 and read down through 11 for me. Boy, his 10:30 sessions are tough. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. They were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah, and they encamped between Soko and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. Saul and the Israelites gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and formed ranks against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley between them. So it's pretty clear where this battle is going to take place. And whoever gets up the hill and takes the high ground is going to be the winner and be able to push the other enemy back. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines, a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. The Greek text, by the way, says 4 cubits and a span. At any rate, he's a pretty darn big guy, about maybe 9 feet tall. If Jerry Krause from the Chicago Bulls could get his hands on him, he would be over to Gath in a minute to recruit. He had a helmet of bronze on his head and was armed with a coat of mail. The weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. He had greaves of bronze on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of the spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. And his shield bearer before him. So this guy is huge. Imagine Wilt Chamberlain with B.J. Armstrong on his shoulders. I don't know, just a huge man with heavy equipment. That anything that you've got, you know, short of armor-piercing bullets, is not going to get through. He's just awesome, as kids say today. He stood and shouted at the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you not servants of Saul?" Note this piece here, a servant of Saul, gives us a slight slant on how at least the text wants us to understand the Philistines understood kingship. Everyone was a servant of the king, which is absolutely contrary to what the Hebrew text tells us the king is. The king is actually more of a servant of the people. More similar to at least the way we talk about presidency, prime ministership in the States and Canada and the Western world, even though we know the truth. Aren't we, you know, why have you come out here? Why are you sitting around here? Aren't we supposed to fight? Basically, this is a border dispute. The Philistines.
There is today.
Actually, quite interestingly, the Gaza Strip is the old Philistia. And if you want to look at the occupied territories in Palestinian terms, or the administered territories in Israeli terms, down where the Arabs have settled since 48 for the most part, is the old Philistine territory. It went out further. And the Israelites, according to their tradition, and the Philistines, according to Israelite tradition, are our best reading of the text, both from Israel and from Egypt, and from up in Anatolia, arrived in Palestine about the same time. And they were down in Judah, the southwest corner.
This being the wonderful map of North Africa, and this being, it's too high, too low, this being Jerusalem. Philistines landed in here sometime in the late 13th century, probably, coming off the sea, and we don't know where. We decided last week they were probably from Scandinavia.
Since
13th century BC. They liked to sail, and when they got there, they sacked cities, and they had a language that's virtually indecipherable.
They were really Finns.
If they were Finns, then yes.
Now we're into it.
They came, they caused trouble down in Egypt, they landed down here, they also landed up here. One of the actual theories about the Philistines, which in the Egyptian material are called sea peoples, is that they were some of the lost Greeks or Greek allies from the Trojan War. But they land down here, and this area down here is Judah. And so it's a constant border dispute. Who's going to hold control of this area, and maybe even who's going to get to the coast? As today, if you don't have a port, you don't do much trade. Even though the Philistines were clearly superior on the seas, they would come across, past the islands, and so on. The Egyptians and the Phoenicians up here
tended to just hug the coast with their boats, basically barges that they would use to get materials back and forth, raw materials from the north usually, and refined materials going back as luxury goods. About the sea peoples, the Philistines were quite comfortable out on the open sea. So it's just as most wars are, who's going to grab the most land and what's in the land that we want. The past couple summers, I've taken some time to read through some historical fiction about the classical period, Mary Renault stuff, Bull from the Sea and so on. Read through the Odyssey and the Iliad, and this summer I'm reading through the Aeneid. And it's interesting to me that in the cowboy movies, you know, you have this point where the good guy and the villain confront each other, and they have this banter. Well, you know, you guys are all wrong about this, and you're such a, you know, lily-livered such and such and so forth. I was stunned. I didn't realize this when I was forced to read this stuff in college, that this is an ancient tradition. And it's here in the Hebrew tradition as well, that this Philistine champion comes out and taunts the enemy. And as we read in the text, it goes on for 40 days. Again, I think a literary device, not necessarily literally 40 days. It just probably seemed like forever to the Israelites, because, you know, if you've got this guy who's 9, 10, 11 feet tall coming out and taunting you, telling you what lily-livered cowards you are, lower than a snake's belly, it's going to seem like forever if nobody will go out there and fight. Yeah, Don.
Peter, I don't know if there's ever been, there's medical stuff in the Bible that's always interested me, but this is one thing. I don't know if there's ever been medical commentary on Goliath, but he must have had a condition called giantism, which is a pituitary tumor that secretes a lot of growth hormone. Mm-hmm. And we used to see this in the modern era before we had better ways to look inside the head with CAT scan and stuff. But these people put out tremendous amounts of growth hormone after their epiphyses and their bones close at age, you know, 17 or 18, and they get huge bones, their jaws and their facial bones, they get uglier than sin. They're very ugly, and if the tumor gets big enough, it presses on their frontal lobe and affects their disposition. Yeah. And they get mean. So this isn't impossible.
Yeah,
and it's always been interesting to me that the most vulnerable, and they used to die oftentimes of hemorrhage into the tumor. The tumor would grow, become mushy, and hemorrhaging into it, and they'd die of intracerebral hemorrhage. And so the most vulnerable spot to kill them would be right in the forehead.
How about that? No, I'd never heard that. I've never seen that in any of the commentaries about this story. But that's a great piece of information. And they get ornery, huh?
One of the ways that when I was younger, and before we had CAT scanning and stuff, one of the ways to pick this up early was if you shook their hands would become very large. Their hands would start growing. If you shook their hands, I had an endocrinologist one time who diagnosed it without even looking at the patient, just by shaking their hand.
How about that?
And they also. But they would get very ugly. And if you ever saw a patient who looked like they had some kind of a syndrome, and the only thing you could say was that they were just ugly, you had to think about growth hormone.
Yeah. And I've seen some players in the NBA that must have that. Does it run in families? Does it run in families?
No.
Oh, too bad. It'd be great for the lesson today if it did. Thought I had a new piece of data that would fit my theory.
We don't see it nowadays because we pick these things up early and they're surgically removed.
Mm-hmm. Well, this guy may be ornery, but he comes up with what I think is a civilized way to fight wars. If we would move to this practice, then we could save lots of money on defense and actually send all of our kids to decent schools. Choose a man for yourselves, and where are we, 8 here, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if we prevail, if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "Today I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. So it's bad, you know, what's going on here, of course, is it's bad enough. This guy's coming out and taunting us, you know, and maybe even though we're outnumbered, do most of the stories of Israelites and Philistines going up against each other, the Israelites are outnumbered. Maybe we could kill this guy if we could get seven or eight surrounding him and fight him off. But he wants to go one-on-one. And my God, someone might ask for volunteers in the traditional military fashion of asking for volunteers. And Saul, of course, realizes as the king, it's the Israelite king, it's his, one of the things that said he's a head taller than everyone, he's handsome, and they want someone to go in front of them in battle. So Saul knows who's supposed to do this. So
it seems like he had to explain it to the Israelites, like they haven't seen this sort of challenge before.
Yeah, this is not typical, and I don't think, you know, I think it's a
Greek festival.
Is it?
Yeah. Champion battle.
Yeah. And it happens in the Aeneid, too. Yeah. It would be nice if we do it today, you know. So Bill Clinton and Saddam can fight it out, you know. So this is the setup to the story that's being told in chapter 17. Now, someone would read 12 through 16. It's just a little piece. All right? Now, David was the son of an Ephrathite. Now, what does the author think of us? We've forgotten this guy already. It's only a chapter. All right? Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, named Jesse, who had eight sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The three eldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle. The names of his three sons who went to battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him Abinadab, and next to him Shammah. We've heard about these boys already, who are not going to be the king of Israel. David was the youngest. The three eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took his stand, morning and evening. All right? Every day, every morning, every evening, he comes out and challenges the Israelites with this same taunt. Jesse said, so that's, again, setting this up from what we've just heard in 1 through 11. Jesse said to his son David, "Take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp of your brothers. Also, take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. See how your brothers fare and bring some token from them." So, good father good father Jesse, even though he's old, much like in the story of Joseph, is sending out the youngest to check up on the oldest. And he sends a little gift to their boss to make sure that they're not thrown out, I think, to make sure that they're not thrown out to the front of the battle, that good relations exist between the commander of the 1,000 and the family of Jesse. But David's job is just to go out and find out how they, you know, deliver the food and find out how they are. Remember that in the ancient world, battles were fought, the armies marched on their bellies in a very different way, and that is that they would take things as they got them, and they didn't receive a salary, they received part of the booty from the warfare, which is another problem for Israelite folks, since in a holy war, usually they were commanded to destroy everything, everyone and everything that they took from the enemy, so there wasn't supposed to be any booty, so to speak. So the family had to provide for the warriors who were off in battle. And I think that continued right up through the Civil War. Looking to our American historian who says, I'm not sure.
Not war, not war.
Sorry. She does women's history. She doesn't do war. I do know for a fact that the commanders were, one of the ways you got to be a commander in the Civil War was to provide uniforms for your troops. So at least regionally, there were some obligations. I think it was an innovation during the Civil War to actually pay everybody a salary in order to fight the war, at least on the Union side. So we get David reintroduced in 17, and this is the part, not quite there yet. Would someone please read 19 through 23?
David got up early the next morning, left someone else in charge of the sheep, took the food, and went as Jesse had told him to. He arrived at the camp just as the Israelites were going out to their battle lines, shouting the war cry. The Philistine and the Israelite armies took positions for battle, facing each other. David left the food with the officer in charge of the supplies, ran to the battle line, and went to his brothers, and asked how they were getting along. As he was talking with them, Goliath came forward and challenged the Israelites, as he had done before. And David heard him. When the Israelites saw Goliath, they ran away in terror. "Look at him," they said to each other. "Listen to his challenge. King Saul has promised to give a big reward to the man who kills him. The king will also give him his daughter to marry and will not require his father's family to pay taxes."
What a deal, huh? I lost my place.
That was up to 26.
Great, thanks. Well, yeah, got a different translation. So David hears all this from the Philistine and hears this about what the promise has been made, sees how the warriors of, he understands, we're led to believe, the warriors of Yahweh or the Lord are responding to this goyish Philistine, this man not of the covenant. Would you just finish through 27?
David asked the men who were near him, "What will the man get who kills this Philistine and frees Israel from this disgrace? After all, who is this heathen Philistine to defy the army of the living God?" They told him what would be done for the man who killed Goliath.
Great. You have heathen, mine says uncircumcised, which is another way of saying non-Israelite, not a person of the covenant. So it's clear to David and his brother in 28, as all older brothers respond, chastises him, says, "Why are you asking this question? You're trying to embarrass us all? Wouldn't you get sheep to take care of back in the wilderness?" And David says, "What's the problem? I only ask a question." And he talked to someone else, and they responded the same way. Everyone's terrified. And they're not, you know, they're terrified and defensive, so they're not going to take any challenge, even if it's an honest question. And David, David is ready to take this on. Apparently, when the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. David said to Saul, "Let no one's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight this Philistine." Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine and fight with him, for you are just a boy. He has been a warrior from youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father." Now, what seems to be the relationship here between Saul and David?
Kind of father and son.
Kind of father and son.
Then that, you know, he thinks he's too young to do this.
Thinks he's too young to do this.
And doesn't have the capability.
Does he seem to know him?
No. But, yeah. I mean, he doesn't understand what he has done as a shepherd.
Yeah. David goes into his explanation of what he's done. Saul seems not to know the guy.
Yes.
Yeah, he just said he was a special.
Yeah, they were, he loved him before, asked him to stay in his service and made him his armor bearer. And now in this story, in this part of the story, he seems not to remember him. Now, it has been argued that this is part of Saul's madness, of the evil spirit that's come into him, but this is a guy who, an armor bearer stays very close to the king. So we hear the story of how David used to chase away and kill lions and bears and probably tigers in the Hollywood version. And finally, I think Saul's just in a spot here. What am I going to do? You know, I finally got somebody who's going to volunteer. All I'm going to lose is a kid. I'll feel a little guilty about it, but at least we won't be embarrassed this afternoon when he comes out because somebody will have come out. So Saul said to David, "Go and may the Lord be with you." And this is, I have a joke that I have carry on with my classes about what it means when someone in authority says, "Go and may the Lord be with you." It's like, fat chance, pal, but at least you're out of my face. So Saul clothed David with his armor. He put on a bronze helmet on his head, and clothed him with a coat of mail. David strapped on Saul's sword over his armor and tried in vain to walk. And I just have this hilarious picture. Now, because we're back to this young boy now, not this man that we saw in the second half, this warrior that we saw in the second half of 16. We're back to the boy, as he's described, the one who's sent by father to check on the older three brothers who are in military service. He's got this full-grown man's armor on. If any of you have young children and you've seen them, or if the children have been young at one time, seen them put on your clothes or your husband or wife's clothes, put on the high heels or the big shoes and the suit and the belt that, you know, wraps around three times, and the suit jacket that where their arms are hanging down to the floor, and then they try to walk and they pretty much fall on their face, or at least if they're smart they say, "I can't move," but they look darn cute. This is the picture I have of David in Saul's armor. He's just, you know, this stuff works for Saul, but it's not going to work at all for David. Right? So he says, "Thank you, but no thank you, sir. This is the sure way to die for me." Then David said to Saul, I'm sure quite politely, "I cannot walk with these, for I am not used to them." So David removed them. Then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the wadi and put them in his shepherd's bag. In the pouch was his sling. His sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. I've always thought that these were little tiny stones, and I'm not sure that they weren't. But this last winter, I did have my first season of archaeology in the desert in Israel, and we came across this wall. We dug down to this wall with stones about this big around. And when I asked my colleague, who's been in the field for about 26 years, how to describe these on the daily report, he said, "Put down a wall of smooth wadi stones." So it gave, you know, I've been thinking of these little kind of stones that kids usually throw with slingshots. There's, at least by modern interpretation, smooth wadi stones are, you know, about the size of a normal softball, not the kind we play with in Chicago. So he goes out and he draws near. There's the big challenge. We're getting to more fun stuff in 41. I'll just tell the story because we're already almost out of time and we haven't got to the other half. David goes out. We all know the rest of the story. There's this taunting back and forth, cursing me. "What's this? You send a boy out? Am I a dog that you come out here with a stick and stones to fight me?" Where are the men of Israel kinds of taunts? David says that this is the battle of God, and God's going to let you eat your words. So they get ready to battle. David takes out one of these stones, whips it around, flings it up, hits him on the forehead, and he falls over. A friend of mine has a great cartoon on her refrigerator where there's this huge guy with a bronze helmet lying on the ground, and underneath him you just see a hand and a slingshot, or a, yeah, a slingshot in this thing. And the caption is, two guys standing off to the side, says, for someone so good with a slingshot, you'd think he'd be quicker on his feet. But David does the job, kills him, and it gets bloody, cuts off his head, drags his head away, and comes into Saul with his head. And he becomes the hero and is recognized now as a warrior. So there's one story of the slaying of Goliath. Right? There is actually one personal piece of information I'd like you to take away from this. And that is, when you think about this story, focus on how David set aside Saul's armor, didn't assume that the tools that someone else was going to use to do the job were the same tools that he was going to be able to be successful in the job with. I don't know how many times it's happened to you that your predecessor or a friend did something a particular way, and you assume that that was the way to do it. I've done it way too many times. David had the presence here to, if you can't walk at all, it's a clear sign that you're probably not ready to go into battle. But David had the presence here to say, yes, this is the way that you do it, but I'm going to have to try to do it with the tools that I know best. I expect that they will be effective, and in this case, they were. You can't go into battle with ill-fitting armor. You can't go to work with tools that don't work for you. And try to find the freedom for yourselves to say that. And recognize the difference when there's one way to do a job, and when you have something to bring to the job that, or the situation, that might not have been thought of before. Let's go on to chapter 21. And this is just another piece of this literary putting together of the Bible, at least the Hebrew Bible. And let's pick up in verse 7. David said to Ahimelech, is there no spear or sword here with you? Did I not bring my sword or my weapons with me because the king's business required haste? So David gets someplace and he's not quite ready to look like a warrior. The priest said, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the Valley of Elah, is here. Am I reading the right piece here? I've got the wrong piece. Sorry. And I'm not going to be able to find it real quickly. Oh, darn. I missed one of my notes. Bear with me just a moment. This is the most embarrassing thing I've done in front of a crowd for years.
You're lucky.
Thanks for that encouragement. No, that's I think way too late in the story. See if technology will pull my rear out of the fire here.
Well, there is a reference in 2 Samuel 21 to Elhanan.
Yeah, where is that?
2 Samuel 21. Verse 18 or 19.
Oh, it is 2 Samuel. Thanks. So I did just write it down wrong on the board. Yeah, great. Flip back with me to 2 Samuel 21:19. It does start off rather similarly. David went down to fight, together. Okay. In 18, after this, the battle took place with the Philistines at Gob, with Sebekai, the Hushathite, killed Shaph. There was, who was the descendant of the giants. Then there was another battle with the Philistines at Gob. Elhanan, son of Oregim, the Bethlehemite, killed Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. Same description we've heard about Goliath's spear. So we've got a double tradition here of someone from Bethlehem coming out and killing this giant. And I like to read this version first with a class and just watch the dumbfounded looks on students' faces when they try to figure out who this Elhanan guy is. And we don't know who he is. One attempt to merge the traditions is to say that David is the throne name. Kings go to the throne and they ascend to the throne and change their names. But that's not satisfactory to me, since Samuel seems to be not, at least the final editor seems to be the same. And I would think that they would want to change that so there would be no confusion. Fortunately, or unfortunately, as the case may be, there's another way out. If we look at First Chronicles 20, verses 4 through 8.
Just before you leave that, the last verse of chapter 21 is interesting, where in a sort of summary way, it says, these four were descended from the giants in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants.
Yeah.
So that David's still given a certain overall giant killer's role here.
Yeah, but not with the one that's named and the one who is the big taunter, not to bring him into the king's presence in a significant way. But yes, you're right. Sorry, I should have taken us farther, but I'm still embarrassed by my gaffe here. I'm a little flustered.
Is this the same story? Because this guy had some other things to matter with. He had too many fingers and too many toes.
Yeah. Well, my son had 12 fingers and 11 toes, so I wouldn't say that that's too many. So. And he's going to be a tall boy. That's part of the melding of traditions, the different pieces of oral history that are sitting out and about that get pulled into the tradition, and it seems that this one had a little more detail and then got smoothed out at the end with there being four giants killed by David and his servants. And in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 4 and following, the book of Chronicles is really a retelling of everything, most of what you have in Samuel and Kings, under a probably 4th century BCE editorship. And so we're back at this is the chronicler's version of the war with the Philistines, wars with the Philistines. This time we're at Geber. We see Sibekai, the Hushite, which comes up again. The name of the person killed is slightly different, spelled differently here. And then again, there was war with the Philistines, and Elhanan, son of Jair, killed Lachmi, the brother of Goliath, the Gittite. So it's this time the same guy shows up. The chroniclers are much better at smoothing things out as they move through the tradition and removing some of what we would call in modern terms contradictions. And they Now they have. Now they've got the, story straight for us. Goliath, Lachmi was the brother of Goliath, the one who, you know, the one who David killed. So the tradition gets smoothed out for us quite nicely here in the Book of Chronicles. And we have ending up with David's brother killing one of the giants. And the same end line here, these were the descendants of the giants of Gath. They were felled by David and his by the hand of David and his servants.
But, you know, in the first one that you read, it doesn't sound like David was likely to have any servants.
Was, I didn't hear, what did you say?
Well, when we read about David being the younger son who's sent out on this little taking food errand, it surprises me then, it seems like an anachronism to say David and his servants.
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess, what I was trying to get at today is that there are lots of versions of each of these stories that were floating around, and there are always going to be problems when you read through one of them.
Right.
Certainly, when you read two or three of them together, if two or three of them made it into the text, you're going to end up with gaps here and there. And this, yeah, we still don't have it fixed in this last one, but at least we've got Elkanah away from Goliath, because Goliath has been named as David's victim earlier.
At the end of that, the story, the first thing we read, where David brings the head in, Saul says to him, "Whose son are you, young man?"
Yeah.
As if he'd never met him at all.
Yeah. And the chapter.
And David answered, "I'm the son of your servant Jesse of Bethlehem," as if this is the first time they're meeting, where earlier in that same part, they're talking to each other, and Saul's saying, "You can't do this," and sort of like knowing him. And so.
Yeah. And that happens over and over and over again in the Hebrew Bible, where. For our mind, it looks it's very disjunctive. If we don't have some sense of the text being put together out of living traditions among the people, so in Bethlehem, or maybe even on the east and the west side of Bethlehem, the stories are similar enough but different. You know, everybody from Holden Village knows how to make egg kaka, because for 5 cents you can pick up a recipe for egg kaka for 400. But there are other people in the United States, probably in the same churches, whose grandmother made it, and they only made it for, you know, maybe two or three dozen people. And they have a different recipe, and they probably don't put the same things in. They get put together in the, is that Swedish or Norwegian? Where does that stuff come from? In the Scandinavian American cookbook, all right? And which one are you going to put in? These guys decided in many cases to put them in, or to mesh them and put them right up against one another. And they didn't have the same kinds of concerns for narrative flow that we have in modern Western literature.
When you say put them together, I mean, at least say with Samuel, is it known whether it was, did a group of scribes come together and talk about that, write together? Is it known at all?
In Chronicles, how Chronicles came together is better documented than the Book of Samuel. Book of Samuel gets lumped into this category of Deuteronomistic history, and that's the kind of stuff that dissertation after dissertation after dissertation gets made of just one piece, 10-12 verses. This is how this came together, where they pulled from for this section and so on, and the whole book. Even the giants at Harvard can't put together, you know, because it's there are too many variables. Was there a question or a comment back here?
Yeah, I guess it seems like we get so hung up on the details of some of these that we probably miss what the intent of the original oral history of the story was.
Well, I think in many cases we do. I also think in many cases the intent of the original oral history was to tell a story that gave identity. Sometimes as a Bethlehemite, sometimes in this case as a descendant of David, sometimes just to entertain. And the authors, the editors were able to bring this together, and they had an eye, sometimes the more important question, sometimes, not always, the more important question is, why did the editors choose this story? What point were they trying to get at? But I think that that first blush, that that this is a story that tells us something about human beings, is the most important part. Human beings who believe that they have a relationship with God. That is the most important part. And sometimes the most important part is, these are fun stories. They catch your attention, they keep your attention, they give you something to dream about, to think about. Sometimes I think there are moral lessons and lessons for life. Like the, when I stop to say, when have you tried to put on someone else's armor? And found out you couldn't even walk because you were so encumbered by it. So they, as the stories are many leveled, the way they enter our lives and each of us differently, they enter in different, in those different levels. And one time it's an instructive story for me, another time it's just a fun story. And other times it's a crucial story for me understanding who I am.
In a sense, I think the church has done a disservice to us because it gets hung up on, I mean, rather than presenting it like that, we get into arguments about, you know, the little details in a sense that that maybe aren't significant. And, you know, trying to say, well, this doesn't make sense, and, you know, one is contradictory over the other one, rather than saying, hey, this is a great story, it helped me understand what God's relationship to human beings are all about and how we flub up or how we, you know, misinterpret, or how we, you know, do this.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think part of it is the, well, I don't, we're out of time, so those of you who want to run on certainly may. I'll keep talking forever, as long as someone's asking questions. Some of it is, I grew up in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and some of the stuff that happened there was, I think, a mistaken idea that there was a contradiction between literary theory, historical critical methodology, and true faith. And anything that would challenge an absolute, yes, the Bible speaks the truth all the time, in the same way that Bob, an oncologist, understands truth, you know, something you can test over and over again, it's always going to turn out the same way. Or something else, a financial person is going to talk about his truth as you add four and four, and you're always going to come up with eight. There are different kinds of truths in different arenas, and we made a big mistake being frightened of other kinds of truth and being seduced into scientific truth as being the same thing as theological truth. So, thanks for your attention.